Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's gonna hate you. And she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last in the Progressive Radio Network. It's PRN and NBL on PRN. I'm Mike Sleva along with my co-host, the good Dr. Guy McPherson. This May 10th, 2016 edition, episode 89 of Nature Bats Last comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico. And from Guy out on tour, our thanks to Afrozin for his theme song contribution. And you can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. This is a call-in show. So please prepare those questions and get ready to give us a call toll-free at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Today we are joined by Dr. John McMurtry, moral philosopher and professor emeritus at the University of Guelph, Canada. Most recently, McMurtry has focused his research on the value structure of economic theory and its consequences for global, civil, and environmental life. McMurtry was named a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada in June 2001 by his peers for his outstanding contributions to the study of humanities and social sciences. Prior to his doctoral studies, he was a professional football player, print and television journalist, academic English teacher, and world traveler. In his autobiographical article, The Human Vocation, an autobiography of higher education, McMurtry recounts the most salient moments of his formative years and states that he came to philosophy as a last resort because as someone naturally disposed to questions, unexamined assumptions and conventional beliefs, I could find no other profession which permitted this vocation at the appropriate level of research. His professional work has been published in more than 150 books and journals. His half dozen books include The Cancer Stage of Capitalism from 2002 and the second edition of Value Wars, The Global Market versus the Life Economy, published in 2013. Welcome to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network, Dr. John McMurtry.
Hello.
Let's start with an article that you wrote last month, which was published at Counterpunch, titled Why the Establishment Hates Trump. Why don't we start by you explaining to us who the establishment is and why the establishment hates Trump. Presidential candidate Donald Trump.
Well, the establishment might be called the ruling class, as Marx called it, and what he meant by it was really rather good, in the sense, basically, that those who are in the establishment are those who can live off their money sequencing alone, whereas everybody else has to sell their service or labor to stay alive. And I would just add to it, in light of what we've seen happen since, and also to perhaps develop that definition a bit and put it into an aphorism, really, the establishment are those who can spend beyond need without limit, and those who have the position and wealth to lie at will for the system. So there's two parts to it. You can spend at will beyond your in money terms, beyond need, and you can lie at will. And I think that's the political class and the corporate media class of the United States, for example, who can lie at will as long as it's for the system. that is, as long as it's denouncing someone who's against the system or causing a problem. Now, the second part of the question was, why would Trump, who seems to be a quintessential capitalist developer and so forth, why would he be hated by the establishment rather than, as I've said, viewed as Ronald Reagan on steroids with all his capacities of reality TV and bullying and so forth? Well, I think it starts with that system that we have in place. He calls a fraud that it's fixed and that it's a disgrace. And so he challenges and calls into question over and over again the whole illusion of democracy that is nonstop in his presentation to the wider audience of America. They're just constantly told the greatest country in the world, the freest country, and on and on and on. And he's saying it's all a fix, it's all a fraud, it's all a lie. Well, right away, the whole, and that's basically a corporate state system, he's taken the mask away, the ultimate myth away, and he will be hated for that reason. But more specifically, he has various policies that show the way in which this false democracy, this illusion of democracy, is basically and increasingly depending on public budgets to make profits that have no service or no contribution to the well-being of the citizens. So he begins with, for example, the Pentagon. What he says here, nobody else has dared to say. Even Eisenhower barely wouldn't say it. About the military establishment, industrial establishment. He says, cut its revenues, cut its public budget, you know, which is all from taxpayers. Cut its budget in half by 50%. Well, nobody's ever proposed such a thing. It takes away the whole enforcement mechanism and the whole feeding basins of the military-industrial complex. But he doesn't stop there. He says the same thing about HMOs or the health maintenance organizations and big pharma, that basically they're robbing the system blind and at the expense of the American people. I won't go into all the ways in which they do that, but he's blowing the whistle on them in terms of the money they're getting from it, and says we would be better off with a one-payer system, which has just been, you know, which is Canada's system and most people's system in the world, that in developed societies. He has gone for the one-payer system, which just means the public, it's not organized by private insurance firms at a huge profit and no ill health services, but also pharma, big pharma, that they must negotiate with the public to set their prices, which is again something that's been unspeakable to even suggest that. And then all the money that goes into elections to condition the people into rejecting this, as such as has happened with Obamacare, which is just for the big insurance. He's saying it's all a fraud and that you must take back the public money. And it's his concentration on the public money being wasted while the people are being mistreated is the key that makes him very unfriendly to the establishment. Actually, they can't bear it. Nobody said such things before. But he goes even further when he goes against the corporate trade agreements. All these trade agreements have no right instituted inside them except the right for transnational corporations to maximize their profits. That's it. There's thousands and thousands of regulations, and they all spin around that single transnational global demand that no sovereign legislation or nation that signs on to them, and you're embargoed if you don't sign on, that he wants to stop them in the sense of not allow what their primary function is to produce cheaply the commodities that are sold in the United States, which is the world's biggest market, to produce those commodities at the least cost to transnational corporations at the lowest lowest common denominator of life standards for both for labor and for the environment, and then put them back into the United States to sell at an enormous profit with no allowance for any discrimination against them. In fact, it's called discrimination. You cannot discriminate against these products, and that has ruined, single-handedly ruined, the blue-collar class and the working class in general, and will increasingly do so. Well, if you come out against the trade system that's doing so-called trade system, it's forced trade, not free trade, and it's corporate rights trade, that's all it is. But to come out against that is, again, unspeakable. You won't even find anyone coming out in any politician or newspaper that is has a chance of winning ever even questioning or raising the issue. And we had many years of the same thing going on in Canada. But moreover, he says, the wars that have been waged on behalf of the system, on behalf of the military, ending up spending $2 billion a day when all is in of public money, that he wants to stop these foreign wars, especially in the Middle East. Well, again, it's that is an unspeakable. That is something that nobody has dared to say except outside the establishment. But he himself is a member of the establishment. So he's really seen as a class traitor, though they don't use the term. But worse than that, he is exposing, he is unmasking the worst of the United States. He even goes so far as to say that that the Wall Street Bank should have been nationalized, and also at the same time, I mean, not at the same time, but elsewhere, he challenges the official conspiracy theory of 9/11. So on all these issues which have been kept out of all of the mainstream corporate press altogether as issues, he has raised them all, and he is, I understandably, hated for it.
Thanks. I want to join Mike in thanking you, Professor. This is Guy. And my next question is, so what happens? I mean, what's next? If Trump keeps pointing out the fraud, is he going to make it to the election?
Well, he's going to, everything's being done to frighten him, but he's actually quite bold, so they don't seem to be able to frighten him, but they can seduce his ambitions. He really would love to be president, and seduce his ambitions to say, well, just shut that up on this, and we'll let you through. Just like in a way Hitler made his deals with the industrialists and so forth and then killed all the brown shirts that were for the socialism that he promised to begin with. So we have sinister possibilities developing out of this, that's for sure. But at the same time, these policies themselves are what has been rendered unspeakable. What I would love the progressive side to do, and it hasn't done, is to call Trump on all these things, to keep hammering them and saying, yes, well, now what are you going to do? Exactly how are you going to do? All those things I listed, for example, the trade, what are you going to do with the trade treaties, which are, you know, signed in secret, developed in secret, and so forth? What are you going to do to reverse them so you protect the working class? So the left has basically just joined in the denunciation of Trump, which I think is totally self-defeating, and they should be. He has allowed these things into the public eye to be discussed. They were formerly undiscussable, and the left's whole attention, or progressive people's whole intention, should be on calling them on it, on every one of them. And I think as to how it's going to turn out, I think really whether the progressive side does that or whether they're allowed to, just go on denouncing Trump and then he's seduced into his ambition of being president and slides in with all these policies disappearing, which the corporate press has done absolutely everything they can to keep underground, then the worst could happen as well. It's up for grabs.
Right. Is it possible, though, that do you believe that the establishment believes what he's saying? In other words, is he saying all these things basically to fire up the populace, and he just wants to get into the club, so to speak?
Yeah,
do they think he's capable of doing any of the things he's saying?
Well, I think he's capable. Yes, I mean, he's I've been surprised at just how gutsy he's been. I had to find all these things out by just looking up the issues and then and what Trump's position on them, because they're so kept under cover. That's where I got all these facts, was not that they were ever reported anywhere or the dots were ever joined, but the fact of the matter is, I've been inside, my brother was a cabinet minister, been inside the political process, and these things are just like people would just, jaws drop in horror if you ever raise this in the Canada's version of the Republican Party, which is the Conservative Party, formerly the Progressive Conservative Party. I've been inside those circles, and to raise those things inside a campaign would just be, as I say, unspeakable. It's taboo. You can't say these things. So, and he has gone on, especially on the trade one, I think everybody knows that he wants to do something about this corporate forced trade that has hurt the working class so much. That's his basic appeal. I think he has the guts, and I think he has the moxie to actually do something significant, yes.
Yeah.
But whether he's seduced by his ambition into being, a presidential candidate, because, of course, on the other side is Hillary Clinton, who herself regards all these things unspeakable. She would never take any one of these on. In fact, she is paid by the establishment and Wall Street primarily to go on, presenting the big lie that Trump is exposing. So it'll be interesting if they get into a debate, because I think he's better on his feet than she is, and that he will start, the good possibility is that he will start exposing her on every one of these, that she's a warmonger, that she's in Wall Street's pocket, and so on. He could really make headway that way, because everybody knows this intuitively in a sense, but they just haven't had the dots joined for them, haven't articulated it, and even he hasn't gotten very clear on policy, which is where the rubber hits the road, the actual policy.
Right, and I mean, she knows, she's been playing this game for a long time. She knows that the many, many initial drafts of Eisenhower's speech had him referring to the military-industrial congressional complex. And then he was convinced at the last minute to take that out, because he had to work with Congress after all. But he knew that they were complicit as well.
Yes, and exactly.
I'm not sure that Trump knows that, or even if he is. It's not clear that he's...
Well, he's going after Congress. The first thing he's going after is Congress, and he's going after 50% of the Pentagon budget. If he said what Eisenhower was going to say, then of course that would make him even more dangerous, even more fascist, even more out of control, and he's a paranoid and so forth. So he may not have joined those dots, but he has certainly gone after the Congress even harder than Eisenhower's addition to congressional and military industrial complex. When he says it's a lie, it's a fraud, it's a hoax, they're all bought, all the positions are bought. I mean, he's not going soft on Congress. And I think it's at a position now that the Congress, if he keeps on going this way, then that's why they hate him, because he's letting the public at least know that something badly is wrong, that their intuitions, which everybody has kept under the rug, the U.S. corporate propaganda system has been completely dismissed these things from even being talked about. And the longer he goes, the more, in a sense, he can, and I think he's probably gaining a lot of votes right now because of these things coming out, and that it would be stupid of him, actually, for his ambition to leave off them and get scared. He hasn't shown himself. The thing is that really I find most impressive, I mean, I don't like the guy as a person, and I think he has fascist capacities, but he has done what no one else dared to do. And for example, one I didn't mention, Palestine and Israel. He said, let's be even-handed about this. Well, you know, that's the most powerful lobby in the world coming after him if he doesn't. Now, that one he might back off of. He certainly hasn't gone on about it. But he even let these things out into the open, or that China and Russia aren't, you know, why don't we make friends with them? That goes against the whole enemy structure of the not only the Pentagon but the political propaganda system, which depends, its only its cornerstone is the enemy. So everywhere you look, he's brought up things. The minimum is he's brought up things that have been unspeakable before, have been taboo to say before, that everybody's been afraid to say before, and he said them. Even if we stop right now, it's gone a long way. Meanwhile, Sanders, what he calls our communist friend, which you can see how, you know, how evil he can be, is doing the same thing from the Democratic side. And so there's a social movement going on, and this is the whole thing. It's beneath the two-party establishment. I mean, it's just the money party with two faces, two heads to it. That's all it is. It's always the money party. Well, it has been for some years now. And so what's happening underneath the money party with its two heads on both sides, one side winning and the other side doing unbelievably well, is a whole, like a whole sleeping giant of the population has been awakened. So I think these are very interesting times indeed.
Oh, yes. Yes, you refer to it as the two heads. I call it the twin cheeks of the corporate ass, but it's mostly the same idea.
Well, it has a lot really of calculus capabilities that the ass doesn't. And that's,
right.
That's his about ruling power.
Ago, you had an about 3 months ago, you had an essay in The Ecologist titled Genocide, Ecocide, and the Empire of Chaos. The summary at the top of the essay captures the story of civilization in two sentences, even though I know you didn't write this simplistic description. Quote, "The true nature of Western civilization is hard to grasp from within," says Professor John McMurtry, "because we perceive it through media whose primary purpose is not to convey the truth, but conceal it. What is actually playing out is a global war of empire and capital against the earth and her people, backed up by the omnipresent threat of overwhelming force," end quote. So we'd like to elaborate, if you don't mind, on your perspective regarding first world.
Right. Well, you know, I've those lines which were put in by the ecologist are, I think, I mean, I'm willing to explain all of that because I think we're really actually ultimately in agreement. I just like to spell out the argument more clearly, but in more steps. But that's, you know, I'm a logician and a philosopher, so we can just stay with what the way they put it. Well, you know, it really begins with when the earth and her people begins with the facts that the air, the soil, and the water themselves are everywhere being degraded and polluted and spoiled and running out. And the oceans are being, the oceans are along with the climate. The climate's being destabilized, and with the, when they never say, they say climate warming, it's being destabilized. And the oceans too, they're being turned into acid. They're being acidified, threatening absolutely everything inside the ocean that's going on. But at the same time, all species, not just inside the ocean, all species are in a general pattern of species a spasm of species extinctions. And so you have at the same time, the wastes keep increasing, the wastes keep being toxic wastes and things that the environment can't recycle or biodegrade keep being poured into the system at great, ever greater amounts. So you start to see that there's more and more contaminated, even at the level of food, it's mostly contaminated junk. I mean, that causes diseases. So in short, what you see in this system disorder, this that is overwhelming the earth and the people and its peoples, is at every level of life organization. Every life system and region is invaded and looted and polluted by this this transnational money sequence system, because it's all being driven, which very few people keep in mind or join the dots on. It's all being driven by a transnational corporate money sequence system that has to have more, that has to have more at the end of every cycle, and those cycles are the next quarter or the next day. They're very instantaneous, and they keep growing and growing, so much so that that's, you know, my work called The Cancer Stage of Capitalism, From Crisis to Cure. That's the 213 volume that's the republication. But the cancer model for this overwhelming force that is destroying the earth and its peoples is actually not a metaphor or an image. It is about actually the behaviors and the operations of this system. You know, what operates, you know, with uncontrolled and unregulated reproduction and growth, and has no committed life function at all? There's no committed life function to these money sequences. They're all basically using all life hosts, whether they're organic or ecological or social or economic, leaving all life hosts as just basically to multiply themselves through it. And then they aggressively and opportunistically, you know, appropriate all the wealth of the public that they can get their hands on, resources, so that the whole corporate system becomes more and more a publicly subsidized carcinogenic growth. But it's not, the key is it's not recognized by its hosts. The very idea of a cancer stage of capitalism, many people agree with that diagnostic model, including high-ranking doctors, but everybody's afraid to say it. And I have worked it out in a very scientifically and logically developed way, I'm very depressed by the diagnosis I've been forced to conclude from, and it's only gotten worse since I first wrote the study in 1999. So we're dealing with 20 years, because I, of course, was researching before that, of just seeing this diagnosis being not disconfirmed, which one always looks for, but always confirmed. So it progressively invades and infiltrates everywhere. Try to find any level of life organization on the planet that isn't being invaded by it as a new area to make money from, and make money towards the top, you know, all of it going to multiply the fortunes at the top, just like a cancer, where it doesn't have any function, but it just keeps invading and appropriating the resources of his life host. And so with no effective immune system recognition, which normally the law and the media, public communications would give us, of course it's all blocked out and blinkered out and attacked if anybody even suggests any one of these things going on, to continue the ruling myth. And so this overwhelming of the people and their environments is occurring, and by force, is everywhere occurring by force. There's nowhere, you try to think of anything that isn't forced back, armed force back. You know, the people who are losing their jobs, people don't even know, 46% don't know where the next $400 is going to come from. I mean, it's just unbelievable. They just, their whole life bases have been appropriated. They've been dispossessed of them. They just don't have them anymore. At the same time, the social infrastructures that formerly regulated things and formerly provided the food and housing and so forth that people couldn't have because they're rejected by the system, all of these things are being stripped at the same time. So what you get is a forcing stripping of all life means and all life hosts at every level, and every step of it is backed by armed force, from the cops to the NATO.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network. It's PRN and Beyond PRN. You're listening to Professor and Moral Philosopher John McMurtry. We have McMurtry, I'm sorry, and we have a call from Sean from Pittsburgh. Sean, you have a question?
Yes. We know that, according to the press, that Trump is a climate denier. Number two, you really need a lot of energy to make our corporate global system work, and this energy probably has to come from fossil fuels. So he's in a bind, it seems to me. I mean, he could turn the Pentagon into a huge engineering company that would come in and take over all the infrastructure and put everybody back to work. But he's in a bind, it seems to me. If he denies climate and he needs energy, it seems to put him into a conundrum, and I don't see how he can get out of that.
Well, I agree, but I don't know where he's denied. Now, maybe he has. I haven't really, I've just researched this thing without having to watch his speeches. I have not seen a report of his denying that there's climate destabilization. Has he denied it? Certainly the Republican Party has.
The destabilization is happening, and I think he sees that.
Yeah,
but
right.
Since he does say that he is a climate denier, then he's
in a bind. I don't know that either. I mean, he can't be a climate denier if he's agreeing that climate destabilization is ongoing.
Well, I mean, that's your inference.
That would be a contradiction on his part, but I don't have the evidence. I haven't seen the evidence where he has denied climate change, or, as I say, beneath euphemism, climate destabilization.
This is a guy who has put his whole campaign as contradiction. So it wouldn't surprise me if it's a contradiction. It doesn't seem to stick to him.
Well, I mean, you know, that's the thing to look at is where. Yeah, that's certainly the press hit on him, that he contradicts and lies all over the place. But here we have an example where he said to contradict and lie all over the place, as always. But then when we look more carefully at what he said, do we have evidence that he has denied climate destabilization, which is the beneath the euphemism? I just haven't seen any such source of this reliable other than the corporate press claiming this.
Well, that's where I got...
You got it from the corporate press. Well, you know, they'll lie, as I said my first thing, that the way you tell the establishment is they lie at will on anything that protects the system.
Right. Thanks for your call,
Sean. So they can project onto him, he's an enemy, like they project onto Putin. They never stop projecting lies onto Putin. Never stop. Right. And he's almost become an enemy like that in the sense that he endangers their interests in a more aggressive at home domestic way that they can't handle.
Right.
So I just need the evidence for that contradiction rather than the New York Times saying it and they lie through their teeth on anything that's against the system.
Let's move on beyond the initial portion of the summary of your article. And you talk about a global war of empire and capital. Well, at least that's what the summary says. And
yeah.
Can you fill in some of the blanks? Who's conducting the war, and what are the primary tools for a war on empire and capital against the Earth?
Well, I think I've already described those, but let me go over again. Who's behind it is not a who, it's a system. It's a transnational corporate money sequence system. And it uses armed force at every level to invade every quarter to maximize its profits without limit and without exponential growth. That's what's behind it all. And then you think, well, you know, that's pretty sweeping. And then the key thing one does in reasoning is to look for counterexamples to the claim being made. And so that claim about what is actually behind it and behind everything that's going on, if you look at it more carefully, if you diagnose to what's driving the whole thing, it's not technology, it's the money sequences that use technology. And look for an exception. And I'm used to those because I've over the years, that's what I do. I try to think things through. And the first thing I do when I think anything through that I claim, I look my very best for exceptions to it or counterexamples to it. And I try to get other people to provide those counterexamples. And that's how the understanding has developed. But I don't see any counterexample to it. and where it's backed by armed force, overwhelming armed force in the end. You know, like he may work in a university, as I've been a professor of a university for many years. But if I fall, if they decided to fire me, as they've fired colleagues of mine, you know, you think everything's decided by rational discourse and so forth. The way the university has come, they will fire people who in any way don't fit into the program, and it is now a corporate meta program, the university itself. So what I'm getting at is the overwhelming force exists even there. They have somebody come on. Yeah, they had somebody come on to and remove by force, although no one's going to resist because it's hopeless, remove by security force the person from their office and all their belongings, and they change the lock on the door. Well, that's overwhelming force for the person to whom it happens, and that's a threat to anybody who gets out of line. And now we have academic freedom, on the other hand, unlike any other institution or domain, which is basically you have the right, the overriding right, to advance learning and disseminate knowledge. It's built right into the constitution of the university. And so you cannot get me for that. You've got to get me for, get anybody for something else. Now, in my case, I was attacked for many years, but as the sort of world recognition came, basically international, it was necessary to have international recognition came, then I became difficult to just do that to. And similarly, other people who managed to make it through this system. Because ultimately they have to respect the academic freedom and they have to respect the constitutional goals of the university. But even there, the most privileged place on the planet, and I would say the lead edge of civilization itself, even there, overwhelming force is used if you step out of line in a way that they can get you on. And what, now, the one thing they can't get you on is for what you say if it's true. They've got to show it's false, or, you know, it's on, you know, someone's very careful, but one wants to be if you're dealing with claims of knowledge. So then I just throw it back, look to where the exception is. That would look to be the most obvious exception, the university common room, the most obvious exception we have to overwhelming force, that a system backed by overwhelming force is running through our earth and its peoples. Look for an exception. And that's
I've been on the receiving end of that kind of behavior from university administration as well. Now, most people I know believe civilization is awesome and the breakdown of civilization will engender violence, but they fail to recognize the omnipresent threat of overwhelming force that actually underlies the set of living arrangements. So how do you respond to the claim?
Well, yeah, the civilization, I mean, I've lived outside civilization a lot of my life too. And what I like about civilization especially is that rational discourse can proceed at best without in criticism without being destroyed for, you know, impiety or blasphemy or the local tyrant or the death squads and so forth. And so civilization to me is begins with rational discourse and science and the arts, which are all modes of mind and consciousness that also depend on literacy, public literacy, for them to extend. And that's what I think civilization is, and at the highest level, the advance of knowledge itself, which I think is the truth of human evolution. But what we have here is not civilization, it's the opposite. It's attacking these things at every level. It's an eco-genocidal system. And I've spent the past while just describing it to you why I call it eco-genocidal. I've had to coin that concept because it's both ecocidal and genocidal at the same time. And it has been right from the beginning, really, but since it didn't hit the people inside the imperial centers, not generally, then they could easily avoid seeing it. but in fact, it's still going on, an eco-genocidal, in fact, going on, really, if you took it on masses of territory, it's going on as rapidly now, perhaps, as it's ever gone on. So it's an eco-genocidal system that is precisely anti-civilization. It's a reversal of civilization. In fact, it's a reversal of human evolution itself. Just think of the things we, you know, other than science and the arts and literacy, that are number one and that you're protected inside that. But just the life protective norms, what one finds. I've traveled through most countries of the world by myself with nothing but a backpack. And the thing one really is glad to receive, and I did generally because I'm a poor traveler and people are usually good to that, is but the life protective norms and laws of civilization, they're hugely important, that just people treat you decently. And Canada's, I think, quite well developed in that regard because we haven't got a police state. But the U.S., although we almost had one with Harper, but the U.S. life protective norms and laws, which would be a cornerstone key of civilization, I find it, I've been to, as I say, I've traveled across the world through the hardest spots, but the most dangerous place by far is the U.S., more dangerous than any of the places where the wars are going on now. I've been through them all overland. It's the most dangerous place in the world, and the most dangerous thing in it are the police, the armed forces. So it's not civilization. Public, another thing that civilization is public health care and the infrastructure for public health care, not just for diseased people, but to ensure the reproduction of people in a healthy state so that they're able to live well and fully. There again, we look at the system as precisely undermining public health and its infrastructures at every level. First, by keeping it privatized all the way and bleeding the people dry of their money to provide less health care than in any other industrialized world in terms of if you even take things like longevity of the people, it's lower than it's lower than Cuba's, for example. So that's another feature of civilization that's very important, that in fact we see reversing in the U.S., going backwards. And, then you get to the thing that, I mean, I've almost died in various places because of water, not having clean water in India, for example. To have clean running water accessible to all is where I would begin civilization. That's you've got to start with. That's you've got to have most of all. And you've got to have a sewer system for the food, for the liquids, to separate the drinking water and the water we consume with our bodies and the waste products. Well, there again, you see that division breaking down all over the place. So this level of civilization is not, this system is actually, if anything, undermining it, for example, by defunding. That is as good as an attack and an occupation. It's better because it destroys its capacity to reproduce. When civilization is ultimately collective life capital, and collective life capital, I define it as capital, but only life is the key term rather than money, is life wealth that produces more life wealth without loss and with cumulative gain through generational time. And you think of absolutely everything that is good about civilization is doing that, extending that life capital development through generational time in ever and ever more spheres. I think the most interesting one in our time is the possibility for knowledge dissemination through the electronic media. But of course, it's attacked too. Its knowledge dimensions are not borne by the corporate media, as we've discussed. It's still the possibilities of people having access to knowledge and understanding has grown. It's beyond anything by far that has ever existed on the planet's face before, and that is the hope. But there again, you wonder, well, what are these communications being kept secure? Is the life capital, life wealth or capacities to produce more life capacities without loss and with cumulative gain? Is that what's happening in the U.S. with our electronic media that allow for mass understanding and knowledge unlike any other time before in history, including of the eco-genocidal attacks going on at every level? Well, it's hard to say that are civilized even there yet. So what people talk about as civilization is that what they really mean, I think, is what they meant at the beginning when they invaded other people's lands and their territories and their peoples and seized them as slaves and as resources and called it civilization. Because the superiority of armed force, and only of armed force, was able to kill them. And so that false notion of civilization, which actually runs against the whole key of human evolution and human advance, is our nightmare hanging on the brains of the living still. And we still think of civilization that way because we've got a great big mass homicidal army, for example. And so what people call civilization, in short, is false. It's not only false, it's the reverse of the truth. And so, just before going on, you think food. Well, we can get food any place we want. Well, what kind of food? In my travels in the States, especially, say, New York City, I can't find food unless I've got money bags on me and go to a restaurant. I can't find food that my body can process. It doesn't exist. It's not there. It's all been turned into junk food that causes disease and it's like throwing a contaminant into your life system. So food itself, where can we get good food anymore? And so the lies and pretense of civilization in the very reverse meaning of civilization still holds us. And that's where that argument comes, which you've just reported. How do you explain their ignorance? Well, their ignorance or ignorance reaches all the way down. It's ignorant. It's ignoring everything that is the opposite of civilization that is going on.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that, John. We're about out of time, and we appreciate your work and for coming on the show. You've been listening to John McMurtry, moral philosopher and professor. And thanks again, John.
You're welcome.
Thank you, John.
Bye for now.
Okay, Guy, you got a climate update?
I do. According to a headline at the University Center for Atmospheric Research, quote, widespread loss of ocean oxygen to become noticeable in 2030. The study referenced by UCAR was published in Global Biogeochemical Cycles, and it includes the following line in the abstract, quote, our results clearly demonstrate the strong impact of natural climate variability on interior oxygen distributions. Even if humans could breathe underwater, we need oxygen to do it. Headline May 5th, 2016, ezinecountercurrents.org reads, 2 degrees was too much. Global warming is out of control. Papers by Nicholas Arguimbao, not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly, a retired lawyer with a physics degree from Harvard and a law degree from UCLA. Well, duh, 2 degrees was too much. As I've been pointing out for years, 2C was a political target, not a scientific one. Even people uneducated in the field of climate science and biology can understand the situation. Perhaps someday the mainstream media will catch up, but I doubt it. The abstract from a paper in the May 6, 2016 issue of Environmental Research Letters reads as follows, quote, here we present the first analysis of coastal dynamics from a sea level rise hotspot in the Solomon Islands. Using time series aerial and satellite imagery from 1947 to 2014 of 33 islands, along with historical insights from local knowledge, we have identified 5 vegetated reef islands that have vanished over this time period, and a further 6 islands experiencing severe shoreline recession. Shoreline recession of the 2 sites has destroyed villages that have existed since at least 1935, leading to community relocations, end quote. the refugee crisis is real, folks. When your home washes into the ocean, when you no longer are able to grow food, when habitat for our favorite species is destroyed, perhaps then will people realize that abrupt climate change is not something I actually invented.
But if we start right now,
yeah.
Your island can be saved.
I've been using that line a lot when I've been on the road here.
I bet.
And please note, regarding my ongoing speaking tour in California, that there is a short documentary film being created, tentatively and descriptively titled Guy on the Road.
Ooh.
We are seeking short behind-the-scenes video clips. If you shoot video on your smartphone or whatever for a minute or less, please send an email message with the clip to info, the short form of information, info@guymcphersontour.com. This can include every aspect of the tour except for presentations. We have plenty of video for my presentations with more on the way.
Any stories from the road, Guy?
Oh, I was in a little town, and even before I went, people said, "You're going to Middletown?" Because apparently it's well known to be the epicenter of rural conservatism in this part of the world.
Oh.
There was a little misunderstanding about what I was going to speak about. I'm not sure how you can misunderstand what I speak about. I mean, I'm sort of the leading voice on this one particular topic. Anyway, I'm about 10 minutes in, and this woman sitting next to me says, "I didn't come here to hear gloom and doom." Well, really? I think you're in the wrong place then.
How many people were there?
There were about 35 people there when she said that, and within 20 minutes, there were about 12 of us.
Wow. So mass exodus. Said,
oh, yeah. Yeah, it was quite impressive. They did not want to hear gloom and doom. They wanted to hear that we can rebuild our houses. This was a town in which many of the buildings were destroyed by the Valley Fire last September. And so they were still really psychologically damaged from this fire. And I get that part.
Yeah.
And I was there to connect it to climate change, specifically to abrupt climate change. Well, they were familiar with the Al Gore style of climate change.
Oh, the friendly climate change.
Right, the we can fix it version of climate change.
Right. Mm. Yeah. You bring the bad kind, so...
right. The kind that doesn't make money for people selling light bulbs and Teflon.
It's amazing. Even when your house burns down, you still don't quite get it.
Exactly. And, I mean, and the evidence is just overwhelming. I mean, within the last month, the New York Times and the Washington Post have both had articles with those three key words in the headline, abrupt climate change. And they were even in that order.
Yeah. I don't know, you know, like people have written us recently and they're sensing our frustration. I don't know what it will take. I mean, clearly you can lose your house in a fire, which is tragic, and I get it. People still don't want to at least consider what possibly, you know, could be going on. So.
Right. And that's the thing. I mean, denial it's one thing to deny anthropogenic climate change. It's another thing to accept anthropogenic climate change, but not have the space to accept the notion of abrupt climate change.
Right.
And I think that's where we're at, because there's still money to be made. There's still room for the grandchildren if we buy into the version we've heard pretty much our entire lives.
Right. It doesn't work in the end of the century scenarios. So.
Right.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, good talk.
Anyway, the next day or 2 days later, I was at the West Branch of the Berkeley Public Library, and it was standing room only. There were 75 people there. And it was a lesson that day in the following presentation, which was just last night, were a lesson in the importance of the first question that is asked. In the first case in Berkeley, somebody said, "We can fix this," and you're just blah blah doom and gloom. And we can fix this, and she just went on and on. And then last night's presentation, the guy with the first question was an artist, and he said, "I'm an artist, and I've been doing installations about ice and having people interact with the installations, and you pretty much got this figured out." And the tone, the feeling, the energy in the two rooms was completely different. And so I'm thinking about hiring somebody as a plant just to ask that first question.
Finally, I have a job.
So far it's been a lot of fun. I've been having great interactions with my hosts and so on. But if I took this stuff seriously, if I took myself seriously, I'd be a wreck.
All right, folks. Well, that about wraps it up this week. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last on Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address in the show, and to share the link widely to the show, and continue to follow Guy's work at GuyMcPherson.com. You can follow my work at The Good Men Project. And we'll see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll chat with actress and blogger Ronnie Dan. We'll focus on population, which people have been talking about on our show. And if you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN or Stitcher.com and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to our listeners and to Afrazin for his music and to Professor and philosopher John McMurtry. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, Guy,
Nature Bats Left.
Gonna get you.